Welcome to Washington Today for Friday, January 14, 2022. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba. Here are some of today's headlines. Hackers brought down some government sites in Ukraine with a warning in three languages that read, "Be afraid." The message on the Foreign Ministry website appeared one day after talks between the West and Moscow aimed at preventing a Russian invasion hit an impasse. We'll hear more from the Pentagon with Press Secretary for the Department of Defense, John Kirby. The Biden administration is threatening to recoup COVID-19 relief funds sent to Arizona over state provisions that it says discourages families and school districts from following federal guidance recommending face coverings in schools. At issue are two state programs that are meant to help schools and students, but actually direct funding away from jurisdictions with mask requirements. In a letter, the Treasury Department warned Arizona has 60 days to remove the anti-masking provisions. The Ohio Supreme Court rejected a new map of state congressional districts Friday as gerrymandered. In the 4-3 decision, justices returned the map to the Ohio Redistricting Commission, or its map-drawing counterparts in the legislature, and said they must assure the next plan actually complies with the Ohio Constitution. Senate Majority Leader, New York Democrat Chuck Schumer, announced late Thursday that the Senate would not reconvene until January 18th, which pushes back his own deadline to force a vote on changing the legislative filibuster. The majority leader had vowed earlier this month to put any potential rule changes to a vote by Monday, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. However, expectations for a Senate showdown were dashed when Senators Kyrsten Sinema, Democrat of Arizona, and Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, reaffirmed their longstanding promise not to touch the 60-vote requirement. We'll have more on this in a moment with Kate Ackley of Roll Call. And that's where we begin today. The Senate stands in recess until next Tuesday, meaning Democrats will miss a self-imposed vote deadline on voting rights legislation. Democrats were dealt another setback Thursday when Senator Brian Schatz, Democrat of Hawaii, announced that he had tested positive for COVID-19 earlier in the week. Well, unlike the House, the Senate does not give its members the option to vote remotely, meaning that with Schatz's absence, Democrats did not have the necessary votes this week to even begin debate on the massive voting measure. Here's Majority Leader Chuck Schumer late last night on the Senate floor.
Due to the circumstances regarding COVID and another potentially hazard winter storm approaching the D.C. area this weekend, the Senate will adjourn tonight. However, we will be postponing recess so the Senate can vote on voting rights. We will return on Tuesday to take up the House-passed message containing voting rights legislation. Make no mistake, the United States Senate will, for the first time this Congress, debate voting rights legislation beginning on Tuesday. Members of this chamber were elected to debate and to vote, particularly on an issue as vital to the beating heart of our democracy as this one. And we will proceed. And if the Senate Republicans choose obstruction over protecting the sacred right to vote, as we expect them to, the Senate will consider and vote on changing the Senate rules, as has been done many times before, to allow passage of voting rights legislation. I will close with this. If the right to vote is the cornerstone of our democracy, then how can we in good conscience allow for a situation in which the Republican Party can debate and pass voter suppression laws at the state level with only a simple majority vote, but not allow the United States Senate to do the same? In the coming days, we will confront this sobering question, and every member will go on record.
That was Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor from Thursday. On the phone now is Kate Ackley, senior staff writer at CQ Roll Call, to give us a preview of congressional activities next week. What can we expect?
Well, you know, that's the big question. There's a lot of uncertainty, but we're looking to Tuesday when the Senate is expected to try to start debate and take up this sweeping voting rights package. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, as you noted, had to kind of do some procedural maneuvering, if you will, in order to be able to bring this bill up for debate because they don't have the 60 votes in order to overcome a filibuster in the Senate. But what they're doing now is they would be able to actually debate the legislation in the Senate next week. They managed to get around that element of the filibuster by having the House pass a bill that had already been passed in the Senate but was different. So it allows them to debate it. But in the end game is still the same. They still either need 60 votes, which would require, you know, 10 or so Republicans voting in favor of this particular voting rights package, or they need enough Democrats to change the filibuster rule so that they would just need a simple majority. And what we saw this week was there's reluctance even from Democrats, namely Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, to vote for any big changes to the filibuster rules. So, you know, it doesn't seem to have a path through the Senate. This voting rights package doesn't seem right now to have a path through the Senate next week. But the White House and congressional Democrats, as well as outside activist groups, are really ramping up and trying to put the pressure on these Democratic holdouts, as well as, to some extent, some of the Republicans, although that does not seem to be that will come to fruition.
What are you hearing in terms of the Biden administration and congressional Democrats working with these two senators in the weeks to come?
Well, we saw some of the senators were at the White House last night. Again, I don't think it's changed any of the dynamics still to this point. There are outside groups and outside activists that are, you know, active in places like West Virginia, Arizona, and here in D.C. You know, they've been doing demonstrations at the Capitol or doing things, ad campaigns back in Joe Manchin's, home state of West Virginia. But, you know, on the other side, there are outside groups that are thanking Senator Manchin for sticking with his pledge to not roll back the filibuster rules. So they have a lot of pressure coming at them from different sides. You know, I think it's going to continue into next week and maybe beyond. But as of right now, there just isn't a way to sort of get this voting rights package through the Senate unless something changes. 10 Republicans say they are going to sign on, which seems unlikely, or if Senators Sinema and Manchin decided that they were going to approve some kind of a tweak or change to the filibuster rules.
What's in the new voting bill the Senate is trying to take up? Language protecting right to vote and have votes counted could lead to an explosion of litigation. That's the article at rollcall.com by Kate Ackley, senior staff writer at CQ Roll Call. If Democrats don't have the votes to pass the bills, why not be honest with the American public about the bill's prospects? And why go through all of the effort just to send a message?
Well, they're under a lot of pressure from activists who really don't want to take no for an answer. And I think they're giving it sort of their all. Now, you're right. Are Democrats setting themselves up for failure with this? It's possible. I mean, but I think that they don't want to look like they're not trying. They have the rhetoric has gotten very heated in this debate. And I think they feel a lot of pressure that they have to bring this priority up and give it its debate, you know, give it air it in public, if you will, and at least try. And that's what President Biden said Thursday after meeting with Senate Democrats. You know, he said, I don't know if we can get this done. I don't know if we can get it done now. Maybe we can get it done at some point, but they were going to keep trying. So, you know, if it doesn't succeed next week, as it seems that it most likely would not unless something big changes, you know, it sounds like they would try again. They would keep going.
What are some reasons Republicans oppose these bills?
The messaging that Republicans have used is said that they don't want sort of federal dictates about how local and state officials should run elections. They don't want to, there's something in here that would, aim to eliminate partisan gerrymandering. Well, both parties do gerrymander districts and benefit from it. But you see Republicans, they don't want the federal government basically to intervene or supersede what state legislatures are putting in place when it comes to drawing congressional maps or, voting, setting the parameters for when to vote and how to vote. And they've criticized other parts of this bill, like some of the other iterations would set Election Day as a holiday. And Republicans have criticized that as just being kind of ridiculous and then something that's not necessary, an extra holiday for the election. So they've criticized a bunch of these proposals, including ones that would require more disclosures of political money by groups that, aim to influence the election. So not, already we see the donations to candidates, that's already publicly available. But we're talking about, the spending by outside groups. This bill would shine more light on some of the political spending by outside groups. And that's been something that current Republicans in Congress have said that they oppose, that they believe it will stymie people's free speech, that it will stymie their donating to these groups because they don't necessarily want to be known as funding some of these, politically engaged groups. So you see Republican opposition to a number of proposals contained in this bill.
But these bills are obviously very important for Democrats.
Yeah, Democrats in Congress, as well as their outside allies, they really believe that this legislation would be transformational and that it would, kind of combat efforts that would, election sabotage efforts. There's a lot of concern about election integrity. And they say that having kind of more uniform standards set by the federal government stating, minimum thresholds for how people vote, meaning that you get a certain number of days to vote by mail, a certain, opportunity to vote in person, early voting, as many states already do, but not all. And so the Democrats argue that this would ensure that, every vote is counted. And that's actually, there's some new language in this new version of the bill, and it basically says, quote, that it guarantees the right to, quote, have one's vote counted in elections for federal office. And so that's kind of where it sets up the possibility that there might be even more litigation, that, election lawyers could come in and sue, a local election board or an official. And say, you have to count all these votes that you didn't count or something. But the idea of it is that everyone's vote must be counted.
What's in the new voting bill the Senate is trying to take up? You can find it at rollcall.com by Kate Ackley, senior staff writer at CQ Roll Call. Thank you for helping us understand these issues.
Thank you.
Despite a blow to some of President Biden's key agenda items this week, he spoke earlier on some of his administration's successes. White House Senior Advisor Mitch Landrieu and President Biden delivered remarks implementing the infrastructure law. The president emphasized the work being done to rebuild America's bridges and provided an update on the administration's progress 60 days after signing the $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure law. Here's President Biden from earlier.
There's a lot of talk about disappointments and things we haven't gotten done. We're going to get a lot of them done, I might add. But this is something we did get done, and it's of enormous consequence to the country. One of the reasons I put Mitch Landrieu in charge of implementing the infrastructure bill is because he gets it. He's a former mayor who knows that the real measure of success is not, did we score some partisan points, it's, did we fix the problem? Did we fix the problem? This is all about fixing the problem. I ran for president to unite the country. This bipartisan infrastructure law I signed 2 months ago unites us around things we all depend on. Whether you're in rural Kentucky or downtown Philadelphia, you should be able to turn on a faucet and drink clean water. Students should be able to get the internet if they need it to do their homework at home instead of having to drive to a fast food parking lot. People need good jobs. Mitch just told me about the man he met in Jackson, Mississippi, who told him, quote, I don't mind working three jobs. I just don't want one paycheck across all three jobs. You know, we've heard it said, talent is equally distributed, but opportunity is not. When we invest in infrastructure, we're really investing in opportunity. These are investments that will build a better America. Sounds like hyperbole, but it's real. So today I want to talk about the progress we've made in 2 months since I signed the bill into law and to make a big announcement as well. Here's some of what we've done so far. The Department of Transportation has released nearly $53 billion to states to modernize highways. So you have to leave 30 minutes earlier to get to work just because of a traffic jam. That's going to be fixed. We've announced more than $240 million in grants to improve ports in 19 states to speed up and strengthen our supply chains, lower cost, and get you the things you need more quickly. We've announced $3 billion for over 3,000 airports around the country to make them more modern, safe, and sustainable. And we're kicking off the largest investment in affordable, reliable, high-speed internet in our nation's history. $65 billion to get to every corner of our country connected, urban, rural, and suburban. Our infrastructure work also protects health, cleans up the environment, and helps us fight climate change. Across this country, people have been struck and they've been struck by all the changes that are needed. They're stuck, they're angry, they're sickened by the broken water and sewer systems, polluted water from the faucets, raw sewage in their backyards. I want you to know, I see you, I hear you, we understand. And I've seen and we've understand the damage done in places like Flint, Michigan, and Jackson, Mississippi. So we've already announced over $7 billion in clean water funding to states so they can fix and upgrade their aging water systems and sewer systems. It's going to take some time, but the money's there and they're getting the money. Our children deserve no less. We've also released an action plan to replace all of our nation's lead pipes in the next decade. This is the United States of America, for God's sake.
President Joe Biden speaking from the Eisenhower Executive Office Building South Court Auditorium. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today. We begin in the White House James Brady briefing room. That's where FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell told White House reporters that the administration is expanding flexibility for the National Guard to help alleviate staffing shortages at hospitals during the current COVID-19 surge. Here's the FEMA Administrator.
So now DOD is deploying 6 additional teams to Ohio, Michigan, Rhode Island, New Jersey, New York, and New Mexico. We will also be deploying an additional HHS team to Rhode Island. And in the next several weeks, we are prepared to do more. These teams are in addition to more than 1,000 staff that are already deployed to 26 states, 2 territories, the District of Columbia, and 24 tribal nations. And since March of 2020, since the beginning of this pandemic, thousands of federal personnel have deployed all over our country. As critical as our doctors and nurses are, countless other professionals keep our hospitals running. Patient transporters, food workers, and cleaning staff are all at the heart of these healthcare facilities. And so for that reason, with the president's support, I am now directing an expansion of our FEMA policy to permit funding to states who elect to use their National Guard troops to fill these critical support roles in hospitals.
FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell at the White House press briefing. President Biden has said that all of those military deployments are fully paid for by the COVID relief package passed by Congress early last year. Next Wednesday, January 19th, President Biden is set to hold a news conference marking his first year in office. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki announced the president will hold a formal press conference at 4 p.m. Eastern to speak, quote, directly to the American people. President Biden has not held a formal press conference since he addressed reporters at the COP26 Climate Summit in Glasgow, Scotland, on November 2nd, 2021. Meanwhile, Minority Whip Steve Scalise of Louisiana spoke on Fox Business earlier today about getting kids back in the schools amid the Omicron surge. He called on President Biden to stand up to teacher union bosses.
You know, you look at school systems like Chicago, where the union bosses took over $2 billion of taxpayer money, and it was designed so that they could open up the schools and get the kids back in the classroom. And they said, no, we're going to keep the money, but we're going to shut down the schools again. All the science says the kids ought to be back in schools. The data, by the way, shows kids aren't learning at the same level if they're not in the classroom. And yet they took billions of dollars and then shut the schools down. President Biden won't stand up to the unions because he's owned by the union bosses. In fact, it was his White House who manipulated a scientific report because the union said, wait a minute, it might show that we should be back in school. And the White House changed it to bow to the union bosses. You got to pick a side. You're going to be with the kids or the union bosses. Unfortunately, President Biden has chosen the union bosses over our kids. And people are fed up with that. You saw it in Virginia, where people said, I want to be involved in my kids' education, and parents deserve to. But they're really, really angry right now that those unions took the money and are keeping their kids out of the schools.
Representative Steve Scalise earlier on Fox Business. Michigan's attorney general is asking federal prosecutors to open a criminal investigation into 16 Republicans who submitted false certificates stating they were the state's presidential electors, despite Joe Biden's 154,000 vote victory in 2020. Dana Nessel, a Democrat, disclosed Thursday that her office had been evaluating charges for nearly a year, but decided to refer the matter to the U.S. attorney in Western Michigan. American Oversight, that's a watchdog group, last March obtained certificates submitted by Republicans in seven states: Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Now, New Mexico and Pennsylvania Republicans added a caveat saying it was done in case they were later recognized as duly elected qualified electors. Americans beset by lack of product choices, rising prices, and the arrival of Omicron sharply cut their spending in December after a burst of early buying in the fall boosted this year's holiday shopping season. The Associated Press reporting that retail sales fell a seasonally adjusted 1.9% in December from November, when sales increased 0.3%. Now, that's according to the U.S. Commerce Department. Spending declines were spread across numerous sectors, including department stores, restaurant sales, and online sales. Virginia Democrat Representative Abigail Spanberger says she believes that members of Congress and their families should not be able to buy and sell stocks. She spoke on MSNBC earlier.
Well, there's an issue where perception is reality. And when we saw back in 2020, when there were reports coming out about different members of Congress who were buying or selling stocks in the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, one of the things that was most notable and disturbing to me was the general acceptance that, look at them, look at Congress, of course. The world is facing a global pandemic, and they're buying stocks in pharmaceutical companies. And that lack of trust that exists, that distance between people and legislators, is something that we have to take proactive steps to remedy, to close that gap. And so I think it's important that we should not only endeavor to avoid impropriety, but the mere appearance of impropriety. And the way that we do that is we say, as members of Congress, we should not be allowed to own individual stocks. Neither can our spouses, neither can our children. We are taking active steps to say, when we are in Congress, in the halls of the United States Capitol, we are working for the people who elected us. We are not thinking about what stock trades we may or may not make. We are not having in the back of our mind information from a briefing we had that morning. We are focused on the people. And if we can affirm that to the American people by saying, in fact, we won't sell or buy stocks, we won't allow ourselves to participate in the market in this way, in order to affirm that we deserve your trust, I think it's worth doing. And that's why we have, I'm so grateful that Chip Roy, Republican colleague from Texas, is my co-lead on this bill. In the United States House, we have members across the ideological and political spectrum. In the United States Senate, Senators Ossoff and Senator Kelly are carrying our companion bill. And as you noted in the beginning, they've made some adjustments to the bill with their introduction as well. So the the trajectory of this issue is really one that's forward moving. And I'm really just excited about the prospect of taking this affirmative step to say, you know, we're making this limiting decision because the American people deserve to know that we are working for them every day we're in Congress.
Virginia Democrat Representative Abigail Spanberger speaking on MSNBC earlier. The Biden administration accused Moscow today of sending saboteurs into eastern Ukraine to stage an incident that could provide Russian President Vladimir Putin with a pretext for ordering an invasion of parts or all of the country. The New York Times reporting that the White House did not release details of the evidence it had collected to back up its charge, though one official said it was a mix of intercepted communications and observations of the movements of people. We'll hear more now from Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby.
Yes, ma'am.
Thanks.
I just wanted to follow up for the second part of my question earlier. Just if Russia does follow through with the pretext for this invasion, how will the U.S. prove it? How is the Pentagon prepared to respond? And does the Pentagon have a warning to Russia?
I think we've been very clear through the multiple conversations that we've had with Russia, particularly President Biden himself, that there will be severe consequences if there's another incursion. So I think we and many others in the international community, to include the NATO alliance, has been very clear about what the consequences and repercussions will be. I won't speak to announcements that haven't come yet or how we might communicate what we're seeing on the ground, except to say that we do have evidence and indications that they are trying to set this pretext for another incursion. And we believe it was important to make note of that, that we are aware, that we do see what they're doing, and that there are echoes of what they did in 2014. And whether or not that actually ends up happening or not, and what we speak to at the time, I think I'll leave to a future setting.
Can I have a quick follow-up on that?
Yeah.
Nonetheless, pretty extraordinary for any administration to speak about this kind of information. So you could have chosen just to communicate it privately to Moscow. Can you tell us why the administration decided to go public?
Your question presupposes that we didn't, you know, that we didn't
indicate to whatever other communications you had.
I think we just believed it was important to make it clear what we were seeing, and that we felt it was in the public's interest, not just here in the United States, but around the world, to know that we know what's in this playbook and how it would potentially play out in Russian state and social media. So that if it does happen, it can be easily identified for what it is, which is a fabrication and a pretext.
And you've said a couple times now what we are seeing. So from that, can we accurately assume that the intelligence is, well, first, generated by the U.S.? You're not getting this through second or third parties, and your assessment is a U.S. assessment. So is, when you say what we are seeing, the U.S. is seeing the information directly. You're not getting it from other parties in the region.
You know, intelligence is a fabric, Barb, and it comes oftentimes from many different sources, some organic and some not. I'm not going to speak to the nature of the specific intelligence other than to assert our confidence in it, and I think I'll leave it at that.
From the Pentagon, Press Secretary John Kirby in a press briefing earlier. States across the country will participate in activities commemorating the Martin Luther King holiday. In Washington, D.C., Martin Luther King Jr.'s family will lead more than 100 national and local civil rights and human rights organizations in a march for voting rights legislation at the Dr. Martin Luther King Holiday D.C. Peace Walk on Monday. The son of Martin Luther King Jr., Martin Luther King III, spoke to Washington Post opinion writer Jonathan Capehart about his hopes for young civil rights activists.
What do you say to your daughter, and what do you say to young activists out there about their activism and how they should go forward, especially when they're just starting to learn that victories don't come in linear fashion? Mm-hmm. In 90 seconds, I think we've got left.
So very quickly, what I always tell Yolanda is you have got to understand there's a long view and there's a short view. There are going to be short-term victories, and some are going to take a lot longer. But the most important thing is we never can give up. And she already has that. She understands. And I say that to young people all the time. What you're doing is changing the world. All the things that you all have done, you got to just look at it in a short period of time. We've made great progress, although it feels like we haven't made, and we certainly have not made enough. We've got a long way to go, but we're going to continue to make progress if you all continue in that tradition.
Martin Luther King III in a Washington Post Live interview earlier. Now, Dr. Martin Luther King Holiday DC Peace Walk will not have a parade or peace rally like previous years due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And now a reminder that all of our coverage is online anytime at cspan.org. And if you missed any of this program, you can find it at cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like more on the stories that are shaping Washington, delivered daily right to your inbox, you can subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba. Thanks for listening today to Washington Today. Thank you.